Project, we are throwing it back to January 2019 today with our two-time guest. This is the second episode that we did with him, Dr. Mike Israetel, and he is one of the coaches, I'm not sure what his exact title is, of RP Nutrition. And of course, we did our first episode where it was all about nutrition, but this second episode, we wanted to do all about training because he knows a ton of training as well. Obviously, he's one of the main, most outspoken guys from the evidence-based camp, you know, along the shoulders of Eric Helms and Lane Norton. So these guys kind of all coming from the same camp, the same belief system. And that's the belief system that we really believe in as well, you know, the science-based one, the evidence-based one. So you get some, obviously some great jokes in this episode, but you get some great information, some really useful stuff on training.
Yeah, be ready for sarcasm.
Yes.
He is one of the most sarcastic men on the planet.
Absolutely. I don't think he can answer a single question without the use of sarcasm. But no, this is a great episode, and we're glad to be throwing this one back with Mike. Supporting the episode today, guys, is the most advanced blue light blocking eyewear on the market. So it's a little bit more expensive, but let me tell you why it's worth it. Because the first pair of blue light blocking glasses I bought cost $20, and they lasted me 9 years before I made the change over to this. So very, very, very inexpensive. However, turns out a lot of these lenses, a lot of these cheap companies created products that obviously filled a need in the market, but no one was regulating. Do these lenses, no one's really testing, do these lenses actually do what they say they're doing? And do they block the blue and green light spectrum from artificial light that keeps us awake at night, or that kind of causes us headaches and causes us eye soreness and tired eyes and dry eyes? And no one tested it until this company, Blue Blocks, came along and was like, you know what, I'm going to test this stuff. And like 99% of the market was not doing what it said it did. So they created a lens and they put it inside a stylish frame that actually does what it says it should do. And as a result, you know, we put them on and it's like, it's lights out. You can't even make it to 10 p.m. If you like watching Netflix and you wear these glasses, forget about it. Like, you're not going to get through your shows.
Yeah, and they look good as well. You can actually walk outside your apartment and not have everybody laugh at you.
Yeah.
But I've been up all night with a newborn and I have about 7-8 hours with the blue light blocking glasses every single night. And I've got the daylight blue light blocking glasses for when you're at the computer screen on during the day as well.
So good. All right, guys, if you want to get a pair of those, go to blueblocks, that's blueblox.com, and use the code MMP, one word, and you'll get 15% off. So that's blueblocks.com, code MMP, when you check out for 15% off. All right, here we go with Mike Israetel. This is Lachlan Rouston.
This is Raph Friedman, and you're listening to the fittest podcast in Australia,
The Mind Muscle Project. All right, Mind Muscle Project, welcome back to another episode of the show. A round two, or should I say maybe the end of round one, with Mike Israetel from RP Strength. And this time, I mean, we slayed diets and zealots on the last one, but I think this time we're going to center it more around training. So firstly, Mike, thank you for coming back on. We appreciate it. We know you're a busy man. We'll finish off with the final four questions as well. But to kind of set the context for all our listeners out there, a lot of them know that we're currently chasing down a 100-day training goal. I'm trying to bench 140 and Raph's trying to clean and jerk 150. And you are an expert on training. I think that's probably a good description. When it comes to strength training, we had a good chat with Dr. Quinn, obviously, who you're good friends with as well. And he talked a lot about the Western versus Eastern style of programming and progression. Where do you kind of fall at the moment? Like, where are you at with kind of your programming? Obviously, you're always learning new ideas and kind of trying to figure out the best applications for strength. What would you say you're kind of leaning in towards or leaning on right now in terms of programming for strength or training for strength?
Well, you know, I think mine can be described, if we're using geographical references, as Southern. You know, I do Australian-based training. So, you know, bogan training is my kind of training, you know, just do fuck all. And, I think there's elements of both approaches that are very good. I think it's a little bit mildly unfair comparison because Eastern training, particularly Soviet bloc training, is just so much more mature than Western training. But Western training is sort of had a real big catch-up period ever since the Soviet Union shat itself and broke apart which is why your boy doesn't live in Russia anymore. Lives in the States. Although when we were about to leave Russia, there was a chance for us to go to Australia. So I could have been fucking talking like you cunt. But I just talk like fucking regular yank or whatever. What do you guys call Americans? What's a derogatory term for Americans over there?
Yeah, probably a yank.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fucking yanks.
Yeah.
Or is it nah yeah or yeah nah? Which one is it?
Yeah nah.
Yeah nah.
Yeah nah.
Yeah nah.
Yeah, it's how you say no.
Yeah
basically.
Nah.
All right. Yeah, you say yes and right, then right, you say right. No. And that's also a way
it's
of saying
polite.
A way of saying
okay.
No thanks. Yeah.
Yahoo. So anyway, am I still coming through okay?
Yeah.
Okay. So I think that, the Eastern tradition tends to be a bit more pre-planned, as you plan distinct mesocycles and microcycles within them and progressions. And then I think sort of Western training may be a little bit more auto-regulated, but I think a synthesis between the two is probably the best approach. So you have a general plan, and then you auto-regulate within that general plan.
Yeah, for sure. One thing that you've made famous, I don't know, is like, maybe the right term, but you talk about a lot is the MRV, the maximum recoverable volume. What are some factors people need to think about when interpreting their own MRV?
Well, so, you know, the best way to interpret it is to make sure that they actually measure their own MRV, because estimates go only so far and sort of end up being guesses. They can be educated guesses. But you have to actually measure your MRV, which means you have to train hard enough at some point to see what your limits are. Mm. But there are some factors that play into MRV. For example, how strong you are. The stronger you are, if we measure your MRV in number of sets per week, the lower your MRV is going to be. Because, you know, you can only squat, you know, 300 kilos so many times per week until you die. But if you're squatting 150 kilos, then, you know, you can probably do a couple more sets and be okay. Another one is your fiber type. You know, you want to see some crazy MRVs, you get endurance athletes in squatting. You know, I've administered 10 by 10 squat workouts to endurance athletes. And I'm like, are you pumped? And they're like, what's that? And I'm like, okay, you're going to get really sore. Next day, they're like, I'm completely fine. And I'm like, what the hell?
Yeah.
Right? So people who are slower twitch tend to recover faster from more work. Now, ironically, it's less... that work is less stimulative of muscle and strength gains for them. So it's like they have to work more to get less, right? And then, of course, your MRV is also going to be affected by sleep and other lifestyle factors, nutrition. So, like, you know, if you eat like shit, your MRV is going to be lower. Mm. If you sleep poorly, your MRV is going to be lower. So the idea is not necessarily to develop the highest MRV you can, but given the circumstances of your genetics, so on and so forth, and your training goals, you want to make sure that you're not needlessly limiting your MRV by following poor nutritional recovery practices.
Mm. Yeah, for sure. And are you applying those same things, or generally, yeah, I'm sure those same principles are applying to sort of like a hypertrophy phase as well, which is obviously putting on as much muscle as possible. Do the factors change, or do the things that maybe you need to place more of an emphasis on change when that is the goal? Because obviously a lot of people set themselves up in the way that I was as well before going into this, you know, sort of strength phase is building enough tissue. So, you know, obviously I was focusing a lot more on trying to eat as much as possible, whereas now with obviously a lot less volume, the food quality is still there, but the quantity is just not as high.
Mm. I think when you're training for hypertrophy versus strength, I think perhaps the nutritional variable is the biggest difference. So I think because strength training largely relies on neurological factors, your nutrition on strength phase only has to be good enough to allow you to recover your actual performance. And this, maintaining muscle is not super hard. It just has to be enough to maintain muscle. So it doesn't have to be completely dialed in. And as long as your calories are good and you're getting enough protein, you know, there's not a whole lot of variance there otherwise. And also, your nutrition has to be good enough for you to perform well in a workout. For hypertrophy training, your nutrition needs to be much more exact because you're actually trying to gain muscle, which is a physiological exercise of altering tissue sizes, which requires enough protein carbohydrates, really meticulous attention to calories, not just keeping an average weight that's okay for training, going up and down here and there, but keeping a weight that's steadily increasing. So I think that on a strength phase, you don't have to pay to nutrition as much. It doesn't mean you have to pay attention to it, not at all.
Of course.
But you can see powerlifters, I guess, are eating cheeseburgers and here there, having some protein shakes and being just fine and being really good lifters. You just don't see good bodybuilders sort of eating fuck all. I mean, every now and again, they'll have a cheat meal, but most of the time, there's sort of the way you tell a powerlifter from a bodybuilder at the gym is he doing eating out of Tupperware? Is he eating out of Tupperware unless he's like a Renaissance organization client? Then you can probably bet with some decency that he's a probably a powerlifter or a weightlifter, right? But if someone, or sorry, if they're eating out of Tupperware, they're probably a physique athlete. And if you know you ask them how their diet is, they're like, oh, it's pretty good. Try to eat enough protein, blah blah. And then you're probably talking to a strength athlete.
You know, I actually had a bit of a difficult question that I couldn't really figure out myself, and I think that you're probably the right person to answer it. Maybe we asked it to another guest. I'm not 100% sure, but I don't know if you've seen the documentary The King, which has been circulating around, the Ronnie Coleman documentary on Netflix. They had a bit of a discussion in there amongst the ex-bodybuilders about did Ronnie really have to go as heavy as he went to achieve the physique that he achieved? And it was interesting because, you know, a whole camp of guys were like, Jay Cutler was like, not really. You don't have to go that heavy to build an amazing physique. Like, look at me, for example. I dethroned him or whatever. And then you had, you know, like Kevin Laverne say like, oh, it's the only reason he had the physique he had because he was the guy putting that much weight on the bar. What's the go there? Is there truth to that? Did he have to go that heavy and be that strong to look the way he did, to look that dense and that large? Or is it true that you can just do it with, you know, 70 to 80% like most bodybuilders do, that don't ever really push strength training to its limits?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would almost certainly fall into the Jay Cutler camp on this one and say that Ronnie could have achieved at least his muscularity if he had trained with less absolute intensity, using less weight, especially in certain periods of his training. And I think that he probably could have become more muscular towards the end of his career by a small margin if he had never gone as heavy as he did. Because going heavy is two-factor. One, it is not as going to get you as jacked as going lighter and being able to do more volume. And then two is opportunity cost, because as you are training heavier, you could have been training in a way that is more hypertrophically sensible. There's a third cost, which is it gets you hurt more, so it fucks you up. And shortens your career or requires you to alter your training in such a way that takes you out of both optimalities. So, you know, it's not that once you get hurt, you can't do doubles, but you can do sets of heavy 10. It's usually that once you get hurt, you're out for months. And then after that, you can't even do heavy sets of 10 for a while, maybe ever at all. You have to do like modified machine bullshit sets of 15 with it. So I think I would love to hear anyone else's take on it. But I think it's pretty straightforward that Ronnie trained too heavy every now and again. Now, was it good for his soul? Probably. Does he regret it? I don't think so.
No.
Is it likely that he would have gotten as hurt as he did, as he is now, if he trained lighter? I'm not sure about that. Total volume is probably a big factor. Technique is a big factor. Could he have had better technique? Yeah, we all could have had better technique. And can. His technique's not very legendary, so, you know, especially when you watch his squat videos, you can sort of see, like, oh, man, he could be doing that a little better. in the form of effect, but in the form of safety, you know? So, yeah, absolutely. I'm very much with Jay Cutler. I think Jay Cutler has been hurt, like, he had, like, a freak bicep tear, like, one time. Entire career.
Yeah.
Ronnie Coleman tore his whole body to pieces. Jay Cutler, as you can tell, is just walking around. So there's lots of other bodybuilders that train very sensibly, rigorously, and Jay was known for pushing the volumes like crazy, but he never pushed the max weights like crazy, and he's fucking huge. So yeah, I think the basic science and what everyone sees in the field on average conforms the idea that, you know, if you're doing doubles and triples and stuff like that and singles as a bodybuilder, probably wasting your time, and probably worse than wasting it. You're probably misusing it in a way that is more likely to be injurious, among other things.
And does it change, like the stronger and more advanced you get? So maybe like early in your career when you really need to start getting stronger and the weights just aren't very heavy,
the singles and doubles and triples are more helpful to get jacked, but once you're getting ridiculously strong, it's less and less necessary and more injurious potentially.
I don't know if the doubles and singles are ever really necessary to get you bigger. They're necessary to get you stronger, sort of, although you probably get stronger doing sets of three to six. They're peaking, right? Sets of one to two or one to three are peaking. They're designed to help you show off, right? And make you better at showing off. So I don't think they're ever really necessary for people who want to get bigger. But I will say this, if you get out of alignment on a 100 kilo deadlift, right, you get out of alignment on a 350 kilo deadlift, it could be the end of your career. So as you get stronger, the place for fuckery really starts to be diminished. And then when you're weak, you can do lots of fuckery and be fine because you're too weak to hurt yourself. There's a little badge of honor for you. So that's it.
Okay. So when it comes to accessory exercises, because I'm trying to obviously build up the bench press, and yeah, I'm definitely staying away from the ones and twos and threes at the moment, at least, while it's still early days. I'm sort of tossing up as to how to do accessory exercises, because you're training the compound movement in a strength way, but then you're almost taking, you're doing, okay, so now I'm going to do some tricep accessory work, but now I'm doing like, you know, 10 to 12 reps, for example, because I've just never really done sets of five on like a tricep extension, super heavy. So how is it best to approach this kind of situation when it comes to accessory exercise, or is it to cut them out altogether and just focus on the compound, or do you just have them for joint health and for you know, just volume, blood volume, or what's the idea here?
Yeah, you know, I'm not really sure, and I think a lot of it depends on personal preference. I'm just kidding. I got a way better answer. So, I should just answer everything with that. People do it.
People do that all the time. I was like, fuck this answer again.
Yeah. So I think the first thing we have to ask is, what is the purpose for which we do accessory work? And there are potentially several purposes. Here are two of the most common during a strength phase. One is you need more strength work in a different component of the lift or a different muscle. It is not receiving a sufficient amount of strength work from its basic lifts, from the competitive lifts. Two is you need a little bit more hypertrophic stimulus in order for that muscle to not lose its size. And some muscles lose size a little bit faster than others. They need more volume to maintain size. Usually it's not much. So you have to first ask what you're doing. So for example, you are training your bench press and your triceps happen. You're right back there, you grabbed your throat for no fucking reason.
No, we're good.
All good.
Jesus, he was like, am I force choking you from over here? Die. So sweet. So, if I could force choke people, I would not be a sports scientist anymore. I'll tell you that right now.
I'm not surprised.
So, let's say that you are bench pressing and you have triceps that are very, very fast twitch, and they're very well trained, and they're very poorly fatigue resistant, and their sort of minimum effective volume for stimulus is very low, and their maximum recoverable is also very low. So you could get pretty much most of your tricep work through bench pressing. And like after four sets of five on the bench, your tris are like cooked. You're like, holy shit, these shits don't work anymore, man. Fuck this. But your pecs might actually just benefit from more strength work. They need more strength work, and they sort of barely feel warmed up. Then what you can do is switch to wide grip pressing, right, and do more work for the chest. In still sets of five or so, much less tricep emphasis, more pec emphasis, and now you're doing strength work for the pecs because they need it, because they can benefit from it. Here's another alternative. Let's say we keep pushing this example. Your triceps are done already, they're fucking cooked, but then you realize two things. One, not only do your pecs need more strength work, but also if you don't put in a little bit more volume work, then they're gonna start to fall off of you, like they shrink pretty fast. So what you can say is go, okay, well, I already put in enough strength work, and if I do any more high intensity work, I'm just going to get fatigued before I hit my volume that I need for hypertrophy retention. Then what you could do is after your, you know, several sets of wide grip bench, you can go and do dumbbell flies for sets of eight for pecs, and then that'll give them enough sort of hypertrophy volume in order to keep them the same size for next time, and then so on and so forth. Does that make sense? So you basically, there's not like this thing where, yes, the resultant structure of training ends up looking like competition lifts, heavy accessories, lighter accessories. But the way you pick all of those is you go competition lifts. Okay, what didn't they hit? Which muscles still need more strength stimulus? Which muscles need more hypertrophy stimulus? Some need both. And then you split those volumes in, and there's your routine. So it's, you know, people say, okay, we're done with bench press. Now we go to close grip bench for sets of 12. Why? Because my triceps need to get stronger. False. They don't get stronger in sets of 10 to 12. They get stronger in sets of 3 to 6. They're like, huh. Okay, so then what should I do? Well, dips, weighted dips, sets of 5. That's a safe thing to do dips with. Shit, even close grip benches are safe sets of 5. Overhead press with a closer grip taxes your triceps like crazy. There you go. So then you do multiple sets. You're like, oh, wow, that makes a lot more sense. Is if somebody comes up to you during your training and you go, why are you doing that? You had better be able to have an answer for them that's really good. Short of just like, well, I need to hit my pecs. Hit for what? Hit for training them in the competition movement for nervous system improvement in strength. Hit them with extra work that de-emphasizes other muscles and prioritizes the pecs for more strength training. Or are you putting in more volume for hypertrophy?
Mm. And is a further reason I've noticed with the clean and jerk training that I'm doing a lot of concentrics and very few eccentrics. So I'm doing like power cleans and, you know, just ripping it up and dropping it, or like push presses where I kind of, there's no eccentric on a push press really, right? Like you catch it on your shoulders. Is another reason like, hey, I need to train these same muscles, but in an eccentric fashion in my accessory work to prevent injuries or keep getting strength or not losing size.
Yeah, probably your last one's the biggest one. There's something to say for all of those, but definitely size. You know, eccentric training has been linked very, very concretely to maintenance and expansion of muscle size. You do concentrics only, I mean, so at some point, concentrics only are too fatiguing, but not hypertrophic enough to maybe keep you the same size. So you do sort of training that is both concentric and eccentric in derivatives to keep that muscle on. So for example, you do a variety of jerks and push presses, but then you're like, yeah, okay, so like for my nervous system, that's enough work. I'm definitely tired. I can no longer explode powerfully. So any more of these is just going to be a bad idea. But maybe I can do some seated or standing barbell presses that have a concentric and eccentric component, and they're sufficiently hypertrophic for my front belt, for my triceps, that I can continue to maintain the needed muscularity that I have. So it makes sense in that regard. And to answer your question about, like, you know, do you drop this out? Do you drop that out? Well, it's a sequential and phasic approach. So when you first start your strength phase, you may have the specific strength work, basic strength work, right? So like bench presses, wide grip bench, and flies, so and your hypertrophy work. Then maybe 2 months out, as everything gets heavier, you have your specific strength work, still competition bench press. Then you might have wide grip, but you might just take the flies and either reduce their volume significantly or just remove them. You're like, I'm not going to lose appreciable muscle size in like, 2 months. Who cares? You get rid of them. That reduction in fatigue allows you to divert that many more resources and have that much more good performance for your main lift and for the accessory work that's heavy, so that you do better. Because, you know, shit starts to get heavy. You're like, yo, why the fuck am I still fucking not even sore? I'm just tired from flies on Tuesday. I got a bench heavy again on Friday. Fuck that. If I take the flies out, there's my benches go better, right? Mm. And then as you get about a month out of your training, this is for the average individual, sometimes sooner, sometimes later, you take out the wide grip benches altogether, your accessory strength work, and now you're doing sets of 1 to 3 in bench presses only. You might do it more frequently, right? And that point, you get all the best technical adaptations, the very specific ones. You don't have to worry about strength improvement anymore because you're not actually in the strength phase anymore. You're in the peaking phase. Your job is not to make yourself stronger. Your job is to drop fatigue while you increase your fitness in a very direct sense of technical ability to express high forces under heavy, heavy loads. And at that point, you're peaking, and so you just do a couple sets of really heavy bench. And then you come back 2 days later and do the same thing. 2 days later, do the same thing. And, you know, with some variation in there. And then all of a sudden, you know, week out, you deload, taper, and then you do a great job. So, you know, to answer is when this kind of thing goes, generally go from higher volumes to lower volumes by pulling away the no longer needed elements one at a time.
Mm. And when do you start that process, the peaking phase typically? Or what do you like to do if you were to peak for a bench? A month?
Yeah. Chad Wesley Smith actually just had a great video on this topic, and it's on his YouTube, Juggernaut Training YouTube. But, you know, really advanced athletes can peak for 2 months. They might need to, you know. They'll walk from a 350-kilo squat to a 420-kilo squat just might take a little bit longer than 4 weeks, you know, because you start 350K in your week one. Week four, you're not ready to go 420. That shit is like, you know, 10 kilometers away from you as far as you're concerned. So you might need 2 months, you might need 2.5. But most people, an average individual, needs about a month for peaking, just to be completely honest, beginners and shit. Dude, they need like 2 weeks. Like, so you have someone who's been lifting a year and they want to do their first comp. You know, if they're doing sets of 3 to 6 in their strength phase for 2 months, that means they're doing pretty close to sets of 3 to 4 at the end of that strength phase. I mean, fuck, man, you have them get a couple doubles in 1 week. The next week, you have them try a couple singles, and then they're fucking golden. They're ready to go. You know, there's not a whole lot of technical, you know, improvement that's going to happen with doing super low volume for super long time. Mm-hmm. So anywhere between 2 and 8 weeks, but 4 weeks is really kind of like the average.
Mm. Yeah, nice. And when it comes to like lower reps, let's just say less than like 3, 2, or 1 reps, some people I've seen on their programs have done like auto regulation for doubles and triples and stuff. It's say RPE, whatever, 8, for example, or 7. And the prescription is until you hit RPE 8 or 9, until you go 1 over. And so that could end up being for some people like 15 sets, 15 to 18 doubles or triples in a session. If you start getting out towards that amount of sets, are you going to end up with some hypertrophy anyway? Are you going to get a good adaptation between both, between strength and hypertrophy? Or are you going to end up too far down hypertrophy, or are you going to stay in kind of the strength lane?
Man, if it takes you 15 sets to get to an RPE 8 or 9 double, then you're working with weights that are sort of just at the bottom of your hypertrophy range, maybe 8 RM or something like that, maybe 6 to 8 RM. You know, the total volume you're exposing yourself to is not really that high. It's just several sets of 6 to 8. So you'll get an okay hypertrophic stimulus, but it's certainly not what you want at the time, because if you're doing doubles, clearly have all the hypertrophy you need, you're supposed to be peaking. And then another sort of way to make it more efficient is, why don't you just have people do sets of 3 to 5? I mean, they'll get to where they need to faster. Here's an interesting concern with that kind of training. Anytime you're squatting, there are 3 distinct things that are occurring. 1 is the unrack and setup. 2 is the lift. 3 is the rack, re-rack. You guys still with me?
Yep.
Catching me okay?
Yep.
So, you know, 2 of those things you don't need to practice very much. Mm. That is the things that are not the lift themselves. And they happen to be pretty fucking fatiguing. So, you know, if you're doing 15 sets of 2, fuck, man, that's 15 opportunities to unrack and set up and re-rack. Why don't you take all that training energy you pissed away there? Just do more effective reps. So if you unrack a weight, this is an interesting concept. If you unrack a weight, you already got it for a ride, right? You might as well take it for a ride sort of close to pretty decent RPE. And if you rack the weight and it's not a good enough RPE, it's time to increase the weight a little bit to get there closer. A good coach, so for example, a very good coach goes by Thomas Neal on Facebook, and he coaches my friend Charlie, who's my training partner. I handle Charlie's off-season, and Thomas handles his peaking. And Thomas will have him do, like, you know, as many doubles as it takes to work up to an RP9. But Thomas knows Charlie so well that he knows it's going to be, like, 2 to 4 of those. It's not going to be 15. If it's 15, your coach has fucking radically misestimated your strength. You're fucking up somehow or something between those two. So I would say that, you know, if you're doing more than like 5 sets at a given volume and intensity in strength or peaking training, you're just asking for purposeless fatigue. That is something we would call junk volume. You know what I mean? The all the volume, somebody could be like, hey, how good are you at unracking the fucking bar? You're like, I'd fuck the best. I did 15 times today. Right? you might as well get some good work under the bar. You know what I mean? It's kind of like the analogy there is, like, you know, guys who like set up like 300 kilos to do like 1 centimeter shrugs with in the power rack.
Yeah.
It's like, man, you're really going to put all those plates on the bar to just do that fuckery? Like, why not just put half the weight on there? It'll take you half as much time, do a more full range of motion. Like, when you actually have the weight in your hands, why don't you just fucking move around more? It'll save you tons of time and get you just as jacked, if not more.
Mm. Yeah, for sure. And one thing that I'm sort of unsure about, I'm playing around with a little bit, is sort of the impact of the days where I'm not doing the bench press. So I'm bench pressing Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and it's kind of in the middle days, playing around with some different stuff where I obviously know that the scap and the delts and all that stuff is already fatigued. And then obviously if I'm going to go do more training on that, then it's going to, you know, obviously hamper my ability on the next day. But how important do you think it is, you know, if I'm pressing one day, on the next day to kind of do, you know, a pulling or to balance it out a bit more, to do some, you know, rear delt accessory work? Or do you generally like the idea of staying clear from that in general, instead doing, I don't know, doing some conditioning on the bike or something, or going for, you know, a weight vest walk or swim or something like that? Or do you don't, or you think it doesn't make too much of an impact there?
So the first thing you have to ask yourself is, how serious about your goal are you, and what is the degree of trade-off you're willing to make? So like, you're clearly like, you know, you still probably, do you train your legs or no?
Yeah.
Yeah. So clearly you're still training your legs, you still train your back. You don't want to just be a bench specialist. So, you know, you're not willing to make that kind of trade-off, right? So there's an optimal way to bench press, which is doing only bench press and it's direct and indirect accessories, and that's it. And they just rest literally the rest of the time. You know, cardio walks. Where the fuck are you going? There's nowhere to walk to where you're going to have a big bench press. You know, do you think fucking Kirill Sarachev walks anywhere? You think Ryan Canelli ever walked anywhere? No. Right? There's nowhere to go except to the fucking bench press and do benches, right? So the real question there is, my wife just got home. I'm sorry. So, the Australians listening and be like, it's 10 in the morning. Her wife just got home. What the fuck does she do? She's an assassin. So basically, you have to just figure out what the trade-offs are. And then within the context of that, you want to try to minimize them. So here are some tips. Insofar as you have your 100-day goal to bench press as much as possible, I would highly advise you to take your shoulder volume and your arm volume and reduce it substantially. I would tell you to reduce your back and leg volume as much as you can to just maintain your gains and not increase them. I would also say that anything that is very, very heavy, very emotionally or nervous system taxing should also be excised as much as possible. For example, I wouldn't probably deadlift much, but I would do maybe some RDLs or some good mornings, keep the back musculature and hamstrings in line. But deadlifts are real tough and they drain you at a systemic level. It's going to cost you bench pressing. I probably wouldn't squat super heavy. Maybe just do some leg presses and some walking lunges. I know it sounds lame, but your legs are going to be the same size after that, and your bench is going to go more. So anything, and this is really easy for all you folks listening to understand, any workout that is not bench press related, after which you're like, oh, fuck, that was hard, that's not good, right? Because that's directly taken away from your systemic recovery abilities through the week. So if you do a leg workout in a bench specialization phase, then you're like, wow, I feel like that was really easy. Great. That's the whole point. You know what I mean? So there's that tipping scale, and how hard do you want it to be? How easy? Well, you know, the more it's on the easy side, but enough to get your, you know, legs and stuff and back to not regress at all. That's my best advice. Walking with a weight vest, fuck, man. If you're doing cardio, that's nice, but, you know, I would do minimal cardio if I was trying to bench press. Do you have a body weight goal?
No. Oh, you mean like how much we should weigh, like on the scale? No. If anything, it's actually going up. So I'm trying to get to 100 kegs, and
bro.
Well, Raph's actually trying to.
Walking to. Walk to fucking Maccas.
Don't worry. That example was not the reality. I've reduced my walking very, very much. The only cardio I do is like 10 minutes of breath work on the assault bike with my legs only. So it's pretty much as minimal as possible, and some core work as well. But for Raph, he's actually trying to reduce his body weight. Well, not really reduce, but just improve your body composition, right? Yeah. But his goal is obviously strength, speed. You know, it's Olympic lifting. It's speed. It's a little bit different. He's got the foundation for strength there already.
Did you guys know that sports scientists studied both powerlifters and weightlifters in a bunch of studies, and they concluded that the most athletic movement the human body is capable of is the bench press?
You're gonna have to explain more on that. How is that possible?
I'm fucking around with you guys. That's nice to hear, though, isn't it? You're like, damn.
Yeah, I knew it. I fucking knew it. Yeah, it's the only exercise you can get pumped up about when you're hungover. Literally everything else is unappealing. It's the only exercise.
No bench.
Yeah.
Yeah. Curls, maybe curls, because, you know, you're hungover, you're kind of carb loaded, and your kind of bicep veins come out.
Yeah, but you're not lying down. The fact that you're lying down makes it so much better. Yeah. 100%.
Junior mistake.
That's right. I do want to dive into these final four questions, but before I do, I did want to ask a more specific question. One thing that I don't know if it's maybe the CrossFit athletes in particular, but they do get a lot of flack for a lack of like rear delt development because they do so much anterior loading through the long head of the bicep, do a lot of pulling off the floor, do a lot of pressing, and sometimes not a lot of like horizontal pulling or scap accessory work. What have you found works best for rear delt strength and development?
Yeah, I'm not sure anyone's ever collected data on CrossFitters to substantiate that claim. They do a lot of pull-ups, which is really good for rear delts. So I sure hope powerlifters aren't accusing them of this because they don't really compare on rear delts or much of anything else. Maybe some people are ignoring the rear delts. So rear delt training can be done pretty well with upright rows. Barbell face pulls are great. That's when you set up an upright row, but you bend about 45 to 60 degrees, and then you just pull to your face, keeping your elbows up, smashes the rear delts pretty well. Bent laterals are good. Every row you do engages the rear delts. And as a matter of fact, the higher the row is, the better. So if you row to your belly button, get some good rear delts. If you row to your chest, like your nipple line, then you get really, really good rear delt activation.
Mm.
It also doubles as a good back exercise. You sort of kill two birds with one stone. So I would say if you have plenty of room in your MRV for training and your back might be a weak point too, upper back, et cetera, I would say do like bent over rows to your chest. I would do bent face pulls with a barbell or dumbbells. There's somebody back there just walked by.
Oh,
there's
good.
An adult female.
She's lost her.
Adult is questionable. Well, Stellar is a very serious podcast.
Yeah,
she's,
yeah.
She's now an international, like, TV viewing audience. So in any case, that kind of compound stuff works super well. On the other hand, if you're someone who needs rear delt work, but it's pretty fatigue constrained, I wouldn't do bent over rows any more than you already are. It's very fatiguing. So what I would do is rear delt raises with dumbbells. And it's, you set an incline machine or an incline bench at roughly 45 degrees and you face down on it and you point your pinkies up and you do lateral raises. And I would say that probably one of the better ways to target is to keep your arms almost completely straight, to point your pinkies up and your thumbs down, and also to pause at the top of the movement just above parallel or whatever's comfortable, the highest it is comfortable, for one full second. And what that really does is engages the shit out of your rear delts. Because a lot of times people just swing the shit around, use 20 kilos in each hand, and that's doing a whole lot of fatigue, not a whole lot of rear delt. I think, 5 kilos, like the way I described, is very challenging for most people to do, 4 sets of 5 to 15 reps.
Yeah.
And is it more effective? I've seen people like go into thoracic flexion, like have maybe something that kind of rounds their upper back while they do rear delt flies, or is that like, is it showing off or something?
Yeah, fuck if I know what that does, man. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Maybe that prevents them from using their back musculature to some extent, but I think, you can probably use some back musculature and rear delts at the same time. A lot of people are, it's interesting, I've been getting a lot of flack about my side lateral raises. As people say, I'm involving my traps, and I never critique anyone squatting because they involve their glutes. So I thought that was for quads. Well, it's a compound movement. It's supposed to involve both of them.
Yeah.
Fucking asshole.
Yeah.
So I think it pays a little bit. I mean, if the whole rounding thing, I mean, I'd like to see what people think about it. I've never seen it. I've never heard of it. Could have some validity, but I'd like to hear about why they're doing that and about how legitimate that is versus just some shit you saw some physical therapist do with, car accident victims or something.
Yeah, I think sometimes it's too much of an isolation of like a portion of already a muscle is like not really effective in any scenario because it's just there's no synergy between the other movements around it. So like, why would you just build one muscle when you could build like 4 or 5 at the same time? So it doesn't make 100% sense to me.
And not incur much more fatigue because it's taking the same amount of fatigue to stay in that fucking weird position.
Yeah, so. Yeah, no, 100%. Nice. Mike, we'll jump into these final four questions. We'll do them on the fly. I'm curious for these answers. The first question is what is or who is someone that is alive today that you would sit down and interview, that would answer any question that you have truthfully. So yeah, who is that person, and why would you choose them?
Can I give you two people?
You can give me two.
So the first is a gentleman named Brian Kaplan. He's an economist in the United States, and I just really love his work. I like the way he thinks, and I would love to talk to him about a variety of questions about economics that interest me greatly. So it's pretty lame. Economics is a hobby of mine. It's also lame. And then the other guy is a gentleman named Ray Kurzweil, who is the head of artificial intelligence development, I think, at Google. And he is a gentleman that, I don't think he coined the term, but he sure pushed it along the term of a technological singularity. Are you guys familiar with what that means?
Yeah. Yeah, we've got a friend who's pretty into that stuff who tells us all about it all the time.
Yeah, sweet. So that's, when machines become more intelligent than people and are able to increase their own intelligence exponentially. Ray Kurzweil pretty much coined that concept for the most part and has expounded on it to a great degree. Ray Kurzweil also wrote a book in the late 90s predicting a variety of technological events because of accelerating technological change. And so far, he has been right on almost every prediction, which is scary. He also says a technological singularity is going to be arriving roughly 2045, which is something to think about. One of his cool predictions was, this is a prediction he made like 18 years before it happened, I think somewhere in like 2015 or something like that. He had predicted that three-dimensional computing was going to be like a 3D processor was going to be arriving sort of that year. It was the tail end of that year, and a lot of people were posting online saying, oh, Ray missed that one. I guess he was too optimistic. And the year expired, I believe. And they're like, so he was wrong. And then IBM, like in January of the next year, was like, we have a 3D processor that's functional. And they're like, what the hell? And like, how long have you guys had it? They're like, we've been testing it in secret for several months. Ray was correct.
Oh, wow. Like,
wow. So yeah, that was pretty baller. So shit like that. So I would love to talk to Ray and be in the presence of somebody much smarter than myself, which is usually the case for me interacting with most people, but he's just so much smarter that, it's... Mm.
Have you ever listened to or seen the work of Michio Kaku, who's a physicist?
Yes.
Yeah, we went and he did like a presentation at the Opera House in Sydney, and I went to his event, and he talks about like these levels of different races, like which human beings are obviously one of those races, and I can't remember the exact terms, but there was like T1, T2, T3, T4, the top tier is someone who is like Star Wars, that can manipulate the galaxy, so like go through time and space, so they can like travel to different dimensions and stuff, right? So it's shit like they do in Star Wars. And then like T2 is like someone who can manipulate their most immediate surroundings. So people who most immediate galaxy, for example, so like kind of the space that we're in at the moment, so maybe they could like manipulate something on Mars, or they could manipulate something on Jupiter, for example. And then the T1 race is a race that can manipulate their current planet's atmosphere, for example. So we can like manipulate clouds and like get a hurricane here, make it rain here, that sort of thing.
Well, we can't do that shit either.
No, we can't. And so we're at T0, right? We're at nothing. But what he was saying was that the internet is the first piece of technology of a T1 race. So like we are like the entry point right now in our time of like a T1, which is like super scary, but also kind of exciting and interesting. So I guess we'll see what happens next. Mm. Because we've kind of entered into that first, we've taken that first kind of step.
Totally. It's exciting times.
It is. But people will still need to get jacked, so that never changes. So that's
totally.
All
I hope the machines are jacked, just for aesthetic purposes.
Yeah, imagine getting just mauled by just tiny, skinny,
lanky
robots.
Motherfucking robots.
Totally. What a disaster.
Yeah, cool. So, second question, Mike, is there anything that you do every single day that you feel like is essential to the success of the day, like routine, a habit, anything like that?
Masturbation.
Is that public or in private?
Yeah, they had a wife.
I don't ever do that shit because a real man does it with, well, I was going to say women, but for me, it's other men. what's a routine that I do every day? I don't know if it's critical to my success, but every night before I go to sleep, I wash all the dishes. My wife is a doctor, so she's always very busy and out of the house. And I don't do much around the house except for work. On the computer most of the day and train a lot, but I do wash the dishes, and it allows me to do just some simple physical work, listen to some podcasts or some, house music on my phone, and really sort of kind of woosah a little bit to de-stress and make a very clean kitchen. And it's very nice to wake up the next day with no dishes in the sink, and you can just get to work and start on a clean slate. You guys ever been in a messy place and you kind of just don't even feel like working? You're like, what's the point of trying to organize anything if everything's dilapidated?
Yeah.
So I kind of want to front load that for the night before.
Nice.
Cool.
Nice. Yeah, I think that has a massive impact on your just state of mind, knowing subconsciously you've just got this chore that's building up and building up and building up. It's just like, even though it's not right there immediately in front of you, it's sitting back there in your mind, and it's distracting you from whatever you need to do, for sure. Cool. Third question, is there anything recently, Mike, that you changed your mind on that for a while you held as a significant belief of yours?
For a long time, I've been sort of resisting Satan's pull at my soul, but I figured, fuck it, maybe taking the dark side. So I used to think that delayed onset muscle soreness was something that you didn't have to have, but sort of the more of it you had, as long as you were healing on time, the better. Recently, I've evolved my opinion to think that an intermediate to low level soreness is probably best. In most cases, for most people. So what I mean by, like, if you're not getting sore at all, if your performance is improving fast, no big deal. If your performance is not improving, you're not getting sore at all, and you're not actually experiencing a lot of fatigue, you're probably just not training hard enough. This is for hypertrophy specifically, right? So if you're not getting sore at all, you might be able to train more. Might. Not for sure, but you could push the envelope and figure it out. And then if you're getting sort of intermediate level soreness, where you get sore for 1 or 2 days, it heals completely, and then you can sort of train again, I think that's a pretty good sign that you're training hard enough, right? So that's actually my sort of central claim is, you know, if you get an intermediate level of soreness, I think you're pretty close to being between your minimum effective volume and your maximum recoverable. Like, it's very difficult to imagine an intermediate level of soreness, you know, it being experienced chronically and simultaneously being chronically in excess of MRV. I mean, Jesus, like, wouldn't you think you'd be more sore if you were always going too hard? And also, you know, if you're getting sore, it's probably unlikely that you're below your minimum effective volume, right? This is the evidence of physical disruption to the ultrastructure, and that's probably a good sign that you're sort of within that volume range. So I think if you're not getting sore at all, it's okay, but experiment with doing more and seeing if more benefits. Recently, you know, the Brad Schoenfeld, James Krieger 45-set study, I'm sure you guys have seen the fallout from all that stuff. Kind of goes to, am I coming in still okay? It kind of goes to show that, like, you know, if you put somebody in like 10 sets of biceps per week and they say, I'm not getting sore, and you're like, it's all right, bro, soreness doesn't have anything to do with growth. Like, it turns out that guy had an MRV of 50, you know, like his minimum effective volume might be 20. So you're basically just at maintenance for the entire time. So you say, well, why don't you keep going until you get a little sore? And they get a little sore at 30 sets per week. And then you look at the progress and it's fucking astronomical. And you're like, well, fuck, you know, there you go. Right. Mm. If you never get sore, but your progress starts to really slide down or attenuate to a great extent as you increase the volume, then okay, soreness is not your indicator, and make sure you're still progressing in volume. If it's too much, it's too much. And at the same time, if you're getting violently fucking sore to the point where you barely even healing or not at all until your next session, you're probably going to be experiencing performance decrement soon if you're not already. So it's one big question I get is, like, okay, I train my back on Monday and Thursday. After Monday, my back is still sore, peak sore on Thursday, and I train again on Thursday, and it's fucking super sore, and it doesn't really ever sort of fully heal until almost heals Monday, and then I hit it again. I'm like, you're probably doing too much, man. So if you just get sort of to where your back is healing completely before each session, I think you're fucking golden. Not for sure golden, but probably in a very good range. So yeah, I used to think, like, yeah, if you can get just peak sore all the time, great, but that's probably not the case.
Mm. Nice. Yeah, that's good. It is always a... Yeah, it's always an interesting take on soreness. But generally, the layperson, they just want to get as sore as fucking possible, which is never good. You don't want to limp around and not be able to get into your car. But for whatever reason, it's like, especially leg day in amateur bodybuilders, they're like, oh, if I can't walk, then done a good session.
what is that whole Australian thing? Like, drink some concrete and harden up or some shit like that?
Oh, that, I think that's American, man.
No, that's absolutely not American. fucking Sydney cunts, eh? There's all those fancy coffee shops you have down there. Spoiled you rotten.
Yeah.
So the deal is, if you're getting unbelievably sore, you're probably expending so many resources healing and recovering that you are probably running dry on resources for pushing adaptation, which is actually improving you.
Yes.
So I think if you are not getting sore at all or really under training, then you're probably not pushing your physiology enough to even adapt because you didn't even have to recover. So I think there's a good middle ground there where your recovery is sensible, but you still have enough resources to adapt. You guys see where that is? Like, if you don't train hard enough, you don't stimulate, you don't need to recover, but you don't stimulate an adaptation. You train intermediately, you need to recover a little bit, but you stimulate a shitload of adaptation. If you train a shitload, then, you know, here's your recovery, here's your adaptation. Like, it just goes whoop, like that, and then all of a sudden you're just like all recovery, almost no adaptation. So the middle ground.
Yeah, nice. And final question, maybe we could do one for this year, seeing as how we're at the end of the year. What has been your favorite book that you've picked up in 2018, and maybe a quote as well, if you have one, sort of as a part B to this question that you've kind of been floating around in your mind in 2018?
Does the book have to be? Does the quote have to be from the book?
No.
Book. Really good recent book is The Case Against Education by Brian Kaplan. That's why I'm a big fan of Brian Kaplan. And the book basically asks a couple of questions of the educational system, specifically in the United States, but all over the world, that a lot of people just don't bother asking because we sort of have like almost a religious reverence for education as like a thing. One of them is, does what you learn in college actually make you better at the job you eventually take? And the answer is, for many instances, no. Like, if you're going to be an engineer or an exercise scientist, like, you just can't really do your job at all unless you know shit. But if you're going to get a four-year college degree and go work at Starbucks, it's really just, you're not, you know, a degree in world history. I don't know what the fuck you use that.
Yeah.
So it turns out that a lot of education is just like sort of going through a variety of loops and hoops and not super clear why we do it. Another thing he sort of questions is, what is the sort of utility value of education? Like, how much does education actually make you better at your job versus how much is it just a way to signal to employers that you are sufficiently intelligent to be employed, that you are sufficiently dedicated to a process, like you could actually show up on time and complete things, and also how much are you a conformist? Like, if you are a really brilliant person who's really dedicated to reading as many articles online and doing their own experiments as they can, but you'll never listen to another professor, you know, I'm not so sure anyone wants to hire you because they're like, hey, work on this project, and you're like, fuck you, I'm working on my own shit. And they're like, okay, this is a terrible decision. So education might be an okay way to communicate to employers that you're eventually going to be good, but that's like 4 or 5 years of school in which we could probably test how good you are at your job will be faster and save the entire economy a bunch of money.
Yeah.
Because one of the proposed ways of making this better was to stop subsidizing education. This is a very politically incorrect view, but I actually think the idea of free education past the high school level is fucking absurd on its face. In the United States, every now and again, as people say, oh, college should be free, university to you guys, university should be free. It's impossible for university to be free because things that you have that have buildings and teachers cost money. So the term really isn't free. It's just who pays for it.
Yeah.
And if you go to school and you pay for it, that means the person you who gets all the benefits of having that job after pay for the school. It sounds pretty just. But if somebody, like if taxpayers pay for it, then some fucking bloke, some fucking bogan who's like a mechanic who doesn't go to school, he pays taxes. He pays for your bitch ass, rich cocksucker to go and take like fucking, you know, social studies or whatever the fuck. And then somehow that's supposed to be good for him. So in any case, he sort of drives that point home. What I think, you know, to most of your viewers, that's probably an interesting, but I think one of the cool, interesting takeaways from Brian himself and from the book is that, you know, sometimes just accepting things as they are, you know, when shit sounds like it's like a good idea, like, yeah, that makes sense. Like thinking one step deeper and being like, does that really make sense? And sometimes you discover like, whoa, fuck, it doesn't. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't make any sense at all. And why do people believe it? And sometimes people just don't like to ask hard questions. You know what I mean? Like, and I think that kind of thinking can play a pretty good in every other facet of your life. Not that you need to be ruthlessly skeptical all the time, but sometimes you need to look around and be like, why am I doing this? Great for training. You know, people say, you know, you got to do this to get big. And you're like, do you really? And they're like, yeah. And they're like, how do you know that? And they're like, and then you start doing research and you're like, wow, somebody fucking lied to me. Somebody's been lying to people for a long time. It's not very often, but it happens. Like
that. Yeah.
And then the quote, I don't know if I, did I do this last time I was with you guys or no?
No, we ran out of time. Science is stronger.
Yeah. I made that up, by the way. That was my quote.
Oh, it was you. Nice.
Yeah. Brilliant, right? So three fucking words. strength is the only thing that matters in this world. Everything else is a delusion for the weak. That was by Prince Vegeta from Dragon Ball Z.
That's good. Nice. So
anytime,
Prince Vegeta. Fuck, I forgot about Vegeta.
Anytime you feel that anything else matters more, remember that you are living at the allowance of the stronger man. It is because of his not being after you that you even get to live. So strength really is perhaps the most absolute thing.
Mm. Yeah.
Which begs the question of who the most powerful man in history is or was, and I have a possible submission for that.
Okay.
Edward Teller. Do you guys know who Edward Teller is?
Edward Teller. He's not the original strongman, is he?
Not even close.
Hmm.
Edward Teller is the inventor of the hydrogen bomb.
Right.
He came up with the single most powerful man-made device.
Hmm. Is he still around?
No, fuck no. He's been dead for like years.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Interesting.
I'm going to say his name quietly because he might fucking come back from space-time continuum and just shoot fucking nukes out of his hands. Just out of sheer spite.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe. He, yeah. Well, he did a lot of damage, that's for sure. Wasn't he the guy, though? I thought that he didn't want to do it for some reason, right? And then, or he created it. Was he the guy that extracted the thing out of the air and then... to make more water.
So there's a couple people. There's a couple people.
Oh no, that's the gas. Sort of thing. No, like, that's the death gas.
Oppenheimer was a guy, a physicist back in the first. We invented the fission bomb.
Yeah.
The nuclear bomb, and he, you know, him and a variety of other scientists had very big reservations about it, and they later were like, "God damn it, why did I do that?" The thing is, somebody had to do it. Edward Teller did have some reservation. He was like, you know, towards later life, he was like, "Yeah, it kind of sucks." But I don't think he ever went far enough to be like, it didn't need to be done. I mean, his invention of the hydrogen bomb before the Russians did was probably the only reason that the United States and the rest of the world is not under communist rule.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
We cheers for that fucking asshole.
Yeah.
Thank God.
Yeah. I think that's the...
Although our training principles would be slightly better.
Yeah, that's true. We'd be a lot stronger.
I mean, scientific principles of strength training, you know what I'm saying? Your boy did that, so... Welcome, world. It don't hurt anybody, right? The hydrogen bomb kills people. Scientific principle of strength training, they just make people more jacked. Well, I guess people could get more jacked and use their powers for evil. So
that's true. Mm. That's true. Which would probably
strong
happen.
Bullies out there.
Yeah, that would probably happen.
It would probably be somebody Australian that would do that.
No way. No, way too chill.
You guys know that, what's his name? Nathan Jones. Do you guys know who that is?
No.
What the fuck? Are you serious?
Is that Aussie guy?
Yeah. He was in World's Strongest Man in the 90s when you fucks were like negative 1 year old or whatever. And he was like a really good lifter. He's like 6 foot 10, right? Like
monster.
Fucking massive, like, yeah, to like 2.5 meters or some shit like that. And, you know, his career, you know, because they say like I'm World's Strongest Man. They never said this, but I'm World's Strongest Man. But, you know, they say like, you know, what's his name is a farmer or what's his name is a shop owner. Nathan Jones' career prior to Strongman was bank robbery. So.
Oh, wow. Wow. That's incredible.
Yeah. I just figured all Australians are criminals.
Well, I mean, it's a convict country, so I can't...
Totally. Man, you guys did so well, because you think convict country, and then you show up in Australia, it's got, like, no crime, and everything's fucking great. And
yeah. Now we
funny accents.
We went the complete opposite. If you, like, sit on a wall and you face the wrong way, like, a cop will come up to you and tell you to sit the other way. Like, that's how many rules we have. But...
yeah,
it's a safe place.
But the cops are nice. It's not like Singapore where, like, you're just being around and the cops beat you to death for some reason.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if that happens, it's like there's a good reason for it. If you're going to die by police brutality.
Singapore, I went there once for a seminar, and I was going to their Maccas, of course. And this girl walks out of the Maccas, and she is, we're fucking Singapore. I've never seen this in the United States. She takes her receipt, and she just goes like this into the air, and then she walks off. There was nobody around. It was just me and her. I was just like...
In Bitch, Singapore?
You're trying to get beaten by the police? Yeah. You're out of your fucking mind?
Yeah.
So what did I do as a responsible citizen? I immediately called the authorities. I followed her. The cops showed up. They beat her half to death. You guys should have seen it. For her life. And I was like, good, good, bitch. Don't fucking litter here. Singapore is my country as well as yours. Shook all the hands of the police officers. It was great. She learned her lesson, I think. So,
shook all the hands of the police officers.
Took pictures with them.
Savage. Fucking savage. All right. If people want more savage shit from you, where is the best place to follow you, Mike?
RP Strength on Instagram. Like a little company we have. Renaissance Periodization. Mike Isertel on Facebook. Facebook's been fucking with its algorithms lately, and I feel like my shit is getting more reach, so that's cool. Because, you know, for a while it was like fucking animal videos and shit like that.
Yeah.
It's just really fucking stupid. Like, yeah. What is this golden retriever? Like, why is he friends with a cat? I'm like, geez, good God. Like, am I fucking 4 years old? But anyway, my Facebook, some jams of wisdom there every now and again, mostly dumb shit. And then my Instagram is at RPDRMIKE, RP Dr. Mike. Mostly half naked pictures of me, not always my genitals, but sometimes, and that's where I can be found. And if you YouTube my name, you get all kinds of videos and cool shit like that. We just put a video on Renaissance Periodization's YouTube that talks a lot about how to bring up stubborn body parts, and a lot of people seem to like that video. It's 1 hour and 30 minutes of a detailed step-by-step algorithmic plan to bring up stubborn body parts. So
that's nice. Cool. I watched that video. Yeah, it was good.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah. Yeah, it was really good. Yeah, it started with a bit of a rant about how it's like, if you can grow muscle in other parts, it's not like the muscle's fault. Mm. It's like you can, it's not like that muscle in particular doesn't have the genetic capabilities to grow. He's just saying it's more like you're just not hitting it properly. Like,
it's not actually a stubborn personality.
Yeah, yeah. It's not that muscle's fault. If you've built muscle in other areas of your body, you can build that muscle. You just haven't figured out how to do it yet. So it's good. It was good.
Or you're just well fucked, like with your calves just small, and you'll never grow calves. You'll cry a lot. Nobody will be your friend. And then you'll die alone with small calves, which again, nobody will care about because your calves are small.
Oh, fuck. You're making us feel fantastic right now. You got a small calf podcast.
Big calves or small calves?
Nah, tiny.
Yeah.
Hold on.
It's on the smaller size.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, fellas. Yeah. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. This should be explicit material. Your viewers shouldn't have to be exposed to calves that small on camera.
Don't worry, there's probably other things they shouldn't look at as well. But no, they should definitely go check out your stuff, Mike. We definitely appreciate you being on, sharing the gems of wisdom as always, and I'm sure people will want a round three, maybe on something else.
Calf development.
Yeah, maybe on calves. But yeah, for now we appreciate your time, Mike.
Thanks for having me on, guys. Always a pleasure.
Thanks, mate.
All right, what an awesome episode with Mike Isertel. Again, just delivering the goods as always. Guys, you can go to peakchocolate.com.au, and then like Raph said earlier, you can scroll down and you'll get a deal on the homepage. So scroll down there, get the bundle pack, the 50-50 of Peak Focus and Peak Active. And then as well, you guys can go to truecoach.co/MMP. That'll get you a free trial and then 50% off your next month if you choose to sign up. We highly recommend it. Also, guys, if you are chasing down your training journal goals, we've really close to the end at this point. So only a couple of days away, if you're listening to this right away, of testing our 100-day training goals, thetrainingjournalbook.com. And if you use the code MMP15, you're going to get 15% off your order as well. All right, thanks, guys, and we'll speak to you next week. Thank you, Project, for tuning in again to another episode of the My Muscle Project. We release an episode every single Monday. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram, the My Muscle Project, to stay up to date with everything we're doing. And if you have some time, leave us a review and a 5-star rating on iTunes.
And don't forget, we have a second show of the week, The After Show. So it's no longer a rest day on Thursdays. If you have any questions for Lachlan and I for that show, head to themindmuscleproject.com/The After Show. And if you ask a question, we'll answer it on the show.
Thanks again so much, Project, and we'll see you all next week.